May it please the court, Jesse Pallant on behalf of the appellants, ability specialists Christopher Oxley and Ricardo Sison. With me at council table is Alan Epstein. This case involves the interpretation of statute 1321.117.5, which provides broad immunity to service providers of the developmentally disabled. Brandon McLaughlin received services from ability specialists in 2005. Christopher Oxley was an employee of Ability Specialists supervising Brandon McLaughlin when Brandon sexually assaulted Christopher Oxley's 7-year-old son. The claims of this case arise out of that incident. The McLaughlins assert claims of negligence against Ability Specialists and Christopher Oxley for the failure to supervise, failure to protect Brandon from dangers they knew or should have known, the failure to provide a reasonably safe environment, as well as the failure to administer the appropriate procedure given the circumstances. There are two issues on appeal. Whether Ability Specialists is immune from the negligence claims of the McLaughlins by virtue of Section 6 in the statute, and secondly, whether Ability Specialists and Christopher Oxley are immune from the negligence claims of Mr. and Mrs. McLaughlin specifically because they are third parties under the statute. The appellants believe that both of these provisions apply and provide immunity to Ability Specialists and Christopher Oxley. First, looking to Section 6, this section provides service providers immunity from claims for the failure to predict or prevent the assaultive behavior of a person with a developmental disability. Brandon McLaughlin was arrested for sexual assault. Whether or not the actual intentions were sexual in nature or not is irrelevant at this point because he engaged in assaultive behavior. The negligence claims are rooted in the alleged failure of Ability Specialists and Christopher Oxley to essentially protect Brandon McLaughlin from himself and prevent his assaultive behavior. So pursuant to the plain language of Section 6, the service provider is immune from those claims and they should be dismissed.
Pardon me, counsel, are you saying that the claims of all of the plaintiffs need to be dismissed under subsection 6?
Yes. In determining that Section 6 did not apply, the trial court read an exception into this section, that service providers are only immune from those claims that are submitted by a person who is an actual physical victim of the assaultive behavior. This is a unique case because the physical victim of the assaultive behavior is Christopher Oxley's 7-year-old son, who's not filing suit here. In fact, it is Brandon McLaughlin who committed the assaultive behavior who's filing suit. However, Section 6 does not provide a limit on potential claimants or specify that service providers are only immune from those claims by people who are physical victims of the sexual assault, as it were. The statute is much more broad than that and provides immunity from any claim having to deal with the failure to predict or prevent the assaultive behavior of a person with a developmental disability. Had the legislature intended to limit to only those physical victims of the assaultive behavior, they would have so stated. Reading an exception like that into the statute and limiting the service provider's immunity broadens the scope of liability to the service providers, which goes directly contrary to the legislative intent of the statute, which is to protect service providers from liability and frivolous lawsuits so they can be encouraged to continue to provide these kinds of programs.
Also, assuming that we find there is some ambiguity in this portion of the statute, aside from the legislative declarations, do we have any other guidance about what the legislature intended vis-a-vis subsection 6?
Not particularly vis-a-vis subsection 6, per se. There's a legislative hearing that took place that is in the materials and quoted in our briefs that also can provide guidance for the court. The claims of the McLaughlins fall squarely within that immunity section of Section 6, and so the court should not have to address whether Mr. and Mrs. McLaughlin are third parties under the statute. However, should the court decide that Section 6 does not apply, it's the appellant's position that Section 4 does and provides Ability Specialists and Christopher Oxley immunity from the claims of Mr. and Mrs. McLaughlin specifically.
Let me just clarify, counsel, your primary position is that subsection 6 applies and therefore we don't need to reach subsection 4 unless we, for some reason, conclude that subsection 6 doesn't immunize your client. Is that
exactly
correct?
Exactly. Section 4 provides service providers immunity from third-party claims. In the industry, this section has thought to be providing immunity from parental claims. And Mr. and Mrs. McLaughlin are third parties under the statute because they are not owed a duty of care. The duty of care in this particular case that Ability Specialists owed was to Brandon McLaughlin, the service provider's client. The trial court determined that a duty was owed to the McLaughlins based on two things: a contract between Ability Specialists and the McLaughlins, and secondly, the mention of family members in a different section of the statute, Section 5. First, looking to the contract issue, there's no contract between Mr. and Mrs. McLaughlin and Ability Specialists for services. The service contract is between Mr. and Mrs. McLaughlin and the community-centered board, Developmental Pathways. Secondly, there's no breach of contract claim made in this case. So to find that a duty is owed to the parents via contract opens the door for extensive liability to all guardians or parents who somehow have an implicit or explicit contract for the developmental or for the service to be provided to the developmental disabled. There will always be that implicit or explicit contract. So a duty of care expands the liability of service providers then to all parents and guardians. In Section 5, the court interpreted a mention of family members in that section to mean that the statute as a whole contemplates claims made by family members. However, Section 5 is a requirement for dispute resolution contemplating claims made by the developmentally disabled or on behalf of the developmentally disabled. The family member's term refers later to the quote of representative or guardian. The appellants acknowledge that Mr. McLaughlin, as the guardian of Brandon McLaughlin, should be able and absolutely must, if Brandon McLaughlin cannot bring claims on his own behalf, bring those claims forward for Brandon McLaughlin. However, that's a very different situation than Brandon McLaughlin asserting claims on his own behalf for his own damages, including personal wage loss and personal emotional damages arising out of this particular incident. Carving out an exception that parents are not considered third parties is contrary to the legislative purpose of the statute and opens up the door for service providers to be liable for any claim that parents or guardians can bring. Had the legislature intended for parental claims to be asserted against service providers, again, the legislature would have so stated. The McLaughlins are not owed a duty in this case, and therefore they are third parties, and Ability Specialists and Christopher Oxley are immune from the negligence claims of Mr. and Mrs. McLaughlin. In summary, Ability Specialists and Christopher Oxley are immune from the entirety of the negligence claims asserted by all of the McLaughlins via Section 6. Alternatively, Ability Specialists and Christopher Oxley are immune from the negligence claims of Mr. and Mrs. McLaughlin by virtue of their third-party status. This is exactly the type of case that the statute was intended to provide immunity to the service provider for. And if the statute's narrowly interpreted and the trial court's exceptions apply to this statute, its legitimacy is in jeopardy, and the service provider's exposure will be exponentially expanded, which is directly contrary to the legislative intent. If service providers are exposed to more liability and the parents are not considered third parties and able to file suit, these programs are going to have difficulty getting insured, their premiums are going to go up, it will be more difficult for them to find funding. All of these are problems that the statute was put in place to combat that issue for service providers and allow them to continue to provide the developmentally disabled with educational programs and opportunities to become integrated into the community without the burden and costs of frivolous litigation. The statute plainly provides Ability Specialists and Christopher Oxley immunity from the negligence claims.
And so one of the briefs, and I think it might have been your brief, mentions that there was some sort of mandatory reporting obligation in this case. Where does that arise from vis-a-vis the child that was allegedly the victim?
The mandatory reporting comes from a statute, and I don't have that information right off the top of my head because that sort of went to the failure the issue of the false imprisonment. And that claim is not necessarily before the court. We don't think that that's preempted by any of the statute.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Sean McDermott. My registration number is 30132. I represent the appellees and the plaintiffs in this matter, the McLaughlin family. I am going to have to shift gears from what I had planned on presenting to the court to address something that I think is extremely critical that was brought up in the appellant's argument. I need to make it extremely clear. We had a stipulation of facts at the trial level, and that is a part of the record. And if the appellees believed that Brandon McLaughlin had sexually assaulted anyone, we would not be here, we would not be in court. And rather than take my word for it, I do feel that I do need to read at least a portion of the stipulation of facts that both parties entered into for purposes of the hearing that gives rise to why we are here today. Brandon McLaughlin is a plaintiff in this case, but he was found incompetent to proceed in the underlying criminal prosecution that ensued as a result of incidents that occurred on June 7, 2005. Michael and Selena McLaughlin contracted with the defendant, Ability Specialists, Inc., to care for Brandon McLaughlin. Ability Specialists at all times necessary was a service agency as defined in CRS 1321.117.5, subsection 2, subsection G. On June 7, 2005, Ability Specialist employee Christopher Oxley was caring for Brandon McLaughlin at his home. This care was being rendered as part of the services that had been contracted for. Christopher Oxley left the room for a period of time. In parens, it states the amount of time is not stipulated. We anticipate that if this returns to the trial court level, that is one of the critical facts that will be determined through discovery and at a trial if this case gets that far.
Counsel, I'm a bit confused as to why you're reading this to us. We've read the stipulated facts. Is there something you wanted to highlight to us?
Well, when we were at the trial court level, Your Honor, and I understand Ms. Pallant was not the trial attorney at that time, first of all, Judge King had issued an order framing the issues that were going to be a part of the hearing. And the issue under subsection 6 was not a part of that order. Mr. Moyson and myself, in anticipation, did at least enter into a stipulation, and Judge King did address the issue that they brought up under subsection 6. And there was an assertion made to this court during the appellant's argument that Brandon McLaughlin sexually assaulted Brandon Oxley, and that's simply not true, and that's not part of the record. And I feel that I felt it incumbent upon me as I'm sitting there and hearing what I believe to be a mischaracterization of the record to at least highlight the record and reiterate to the court what was actually stipulated to at the trial level.
Thank you, counsel. I think we are aware of what the actual stipulation was. Okay. Thank you.
And I will go ahead, and instead of dealing with subsection 5, first of all, I will go ahead and I will address subsection 6. My position, first of all, is there are not any facts demonstrating that an assault did occur, and so on its face, you're missing something that you need to begin with in subsection 6. Additionally, the plain reading of subsection 6 is inapposite to anything that did occur in this particular case.
Subsection 6 refers to assaultive, disorderly, or harassing behavior. And even assuming that there was no actual sexual assault, couldn't the behavior fit that fairly broad definition?
Your Honor, the subsection 6 does go on to talk about the duty to warn, and I know, Your Honor, you authored, I believe, the only opinion that so far has dealt with this particular statute, and in that particular case that you authored, it dealt with, well, it at least addressed subsection 6, and in that particular case, as you know, it was a victim of a sex assault who attempted to bring suit after she had been sexually assaulted by someone else who was receiving services. And without mentioning that case in particular, because I frankly believe at the time that we did this last year, the parties and Judge King were unaware of the case, Judge King pointed out in his findings of fact that subsection 6 applies to a duty to warn for third persons. And as Judge King pointed out in his findings, he indicated if this was a case where I won't mention his name because he was a juvenile and still is, but the boy involved in this case, if he had in fact been assaulted and he was a third party, then he would be precluded from bringing a lawsuit against the provider. And that is the purpose of the entire statute. It's to provide for reasonable limitations on liability.
Well, let me ask you about that, counsel. Excuse me. It doesn't say anything about victim. It doesn't mention who the plaintiffs can be. It simply says it's applicable in any civil action. Are you asking us to read in a provision that's not there in subsection 6?
Your Honor, may I have just a moment, please?
Of course.
Your Honor, a provider shall not be liable for damages in any civil action for failure to warn or protect any person against the violent, assaultive, disorderly, or harassing behavior of a person with a developmental disability, nor shall any such provider be held civilly liable for failure to predict or prevent such behavior. And I believe the point that Judge King was making, that the way that reads to him, and my position is that the plain language of that does discuss that the general public cannot bring a suit because of the actions of someone that is being supervised. And in this particular case, it's Brandon McLaughlin, who was not in no way, shape, or form, can it be construed that he was the recipient of any sort of violent, assaultive, or disorderly behavior.
Well, your opponent is reading your complaint as alleging that Brandon McLaughlin was someone that should have been protected against his own behavior. How do you respond to that?
I will simply say that with respect to the complaint and the allegation in the complaint, that is a correct assertion. Our complaint was premised on the fact and the alleged fact, and Mr. McLaughlin testified to it in the underlying hearing, that he had told ability specialists that Brandon had previous problems, that he needed to be watched like a hawk, and he was not to be left unattended. He gave an example that when he went through Denver International Airport, he went through a metal detector, security had to be called, and despite that, he was not supervised on this particular occasion. The provider left the room, left them unattended, and then this occurred. But there are no facts to suggest, and you've read the stipulation, that there was any sort of actual assaultive behavior. There
was, couldn't it be considered disorderly behavior or harassing behavior, which are also in the statute?
Well, what the record indicates is that a young boy was playing with a ball. He went after the ball. His pajama bottom had come down. A developmentally disabled person with an IQ of 57 gave him a spanking, and he thought the little boy may have been hurt, and then he kissed him. And the police officer himself indicated that he did not believe that there was any sexual connotation related to that.
So help me please understand why that conduct can't be viewed as disorderly or harassing behavior.
Well, perhaps if the court chooses to remand the case at the trial level and additional facts are presented to show that there was, in fact, assaultive or...
Well, hang on. Let's talk about the facts we've got right here in the stipulation. Okay. Please help me understand how the facts that have been stipulated to the spanking, the pulling down the pants, and the kissing, how that is not, could not possibly be viewed as disorderly or harassing behavior.
Well, in terms of the Colorado statute for harassment, there's no specific intent there to harass, alarm, or annoy. It does not meet the statutory definition of third-degree assault, which is knowingly or recklessly causing injury to another. In terms of any sort of disorderly conduct, I cannot recite the municipal codes off the top of my head, but generally they would have something to do with something done in a public place that was disruptive to the general public at large.
The statute doesn't mention the disorderly conduct municipal codes or anything like that. It just says disorderly conduct. Why couldn't this kind of conduct be considered disorderly just by a plain reading of the statute?
Well, Your Honor, I will tell the court that I agreed with Judge King's reading of the statute, and I thought from the plain language of the statute, this dealt with third-party potential victims. As I did prepare for this, I did listen to Representative Fritz's introductory comments as the bill was being proposed. And he indicates in his introductory comments that the way I'm interpreting the plain reading of the statute is what he had in mind. And I believe, and I apologize, I would have put that in my brief. I relied on the first prong of statutory construction, which is the plain reading of the statute. If I can request leave of the court, and if it's helpful to the court, I can provide a copy of that tape, Your Honor.
Well, your position has been that the statute is unambiguous, and if it is unambiguous, we're not supposed to listen to the legislative history. I'll just leave it at that.
I agree, Your Honor. I apologize. I believe there's... You're asking a question. You're reading something different than I do. So apparently, there's at least a little ambiguity, right here at this particular time. But that is my position. My position is subsection 6 is there to to protect service providers, so, because there was a recognition, and it's in the preamble of the statute, that this is a relatively high-risk population that does need to be served, and as such, we're not going to hold service providers accountable for everything that the people they provide services to do, because that would be unfair and expensive for them. Okay. Thank you.
Any rebuttal?
Your Honors, the legislative declaration is very clear in its intent to provide immunity to the service providers for unnecessary and frivolous litigation. Excuse me. It is our position that Section 6 is plain, and by its plain meaning and based on the legislative declaration, the actions of Brandon McLaughlin and the claims of the McLaughlins for negligence should be dismissed, because the service provider is granted immunity by the statute.
I have a quick question about the language of the statute. If there's a factual issue about whether this particular incident qualified as assaultive, disorderly, or harassing, would the court enter summary judgment, or would that go back?
That would go back. It is our stance that the statute's broad enough to encompass the activity that happened here. The stipulations of facts specifically give descriptions of assaultive and disorderly behavior, and therefore we think that Section 6 provides ability specialists and Christopher Oxley immunity in this situation. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all for your fine arguments. The case will be deemed submitted, and you may expect a written opinion in due course.